Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Tiger Bales and Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals, welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Morning, Amy. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good after the weekend, Tiger, but my microphone's not on.
It's not on? Do you need it on? Yeah. Will you need it on? All right, okay. Sorry.
It is Monday. Didn't have my microphone on. It is Monday.
There you go.
Yeah, no, I had a good weekend, but I was quite sad over the weekend because of that young girl, Tyler Lee Palmer, who was found.
Young Marston schoolgirl.
Yeah, found out near in a river out near Jacob's Well.
Pimpama River.
And that's right up from where I live. So I was quite sad about it because you didn't hear about her. She'd gone missing for 6 days before police alerted anyone. And she was a foster care child. So she'd run away, apparently, according to media reports. So it's really sad, and it just always makes me think, you know, a young girl from a sort of a disadvantaged background, and you don't hear about her, which is, you know, it's just Australia. You can't argue with it. If she was a young white girl from a wealthy suburb, you would have heard about her from now. Definitely. I mean, that's just
from
a fact.
From day one, not after 6 days has passed and stuff.
Yeah, and we see it continually. So I've just been thinking about her and send my, you know, condolences out to her family, but also if you saw anything around the Logan area, around Marsden High School around that time, I think it's October 30th, if police want to hear from you. So I just want to send that message out, and hopefully this young girl gets justice and her family gets justice. But I'm just really angry at the system, I think. So
she ran away from home.
She was placed in carers.
She ran away from her carers.
Yeah, which she'd done a couple of times, which a lot of kids who are placed in care do, and we know about that in Aboriginal Australia, you know.
Well, that's obviously a call for help.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't run away from these places, from their own homes or carers, foster care, without any real reason being there, generally speaking.
Yeah. It shows the system's failed this girl, but I just wanted to send a message of condolences out to her family around wherever they are.
Mm. All right, Amy, our guest today.
We've got Corey Feller from the First Peoples Disability Network Australia, but he also runs the Murray Disability Advisory Network in Queensland, and we're going to be talking about an issue that isn't often reported around the place, even in Aboriginal affairs, and it's about our mob with disabilities. So we've got this fella on, Paul Culcott. Paul, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks very much for having me.
You got a phone on a speakerphone, have you?
No, just a normal phone.
Normal phone, it's held up beside your head. Right.
Yep.
Okay, I won't send the police in looking for you. Thank you. No, that's cool, Paul. Those speaker phones don't work. The conference phones don't work well on the radio.
No, they don't work much at all, really.
All right, welcome to the program, man. Tell us your mob in your country.
We're Rosary from down around Bathurst and Wellington, my family's from.
Oh, yeah.
But grew up in Sydney, grew up in Gadigal country, out around Parramatta. But moved up to Queensland about 10 years ago.
All right.
So now living on Gubbi Gubbi country up on the Sunshine Coast.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And we're going to be talking about our mob with disabilities today, Paul, and I was actually interested to see the statistic. It's about 37%, the proportion of Indigenous people 15 years and over reporting a disability is about 37%, so it's about 102,000 people, it says, the First Nations Disability Network says. We don't really talk about the statistic, do we?
No, we don't. Well, most of them, of course, they're pretty inaccurate. I think at one stage there was estimations that it was only 1.5% of the Aboriginal population in Queensland were living with disability. And, of course, as you just said, Amy, our stats say it's more around the 30% mark. But the last ABS showed that 50% of the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander population were living with a disability or a long-term chronic health condition.
And what does that include? I mean, how do we define a disability? What sort of health conditions?
Well, it's really hard to even define disability in the community because we haven't even got a word for it, really. Yeah. And it's not something you sort of talk about. You don't sort of spotlight people with disability. It's usually just how you are. Like, you know, uncle might need a bit of a hand hearing there. He can't hear well, so make sure you speak up. Or with myself, I contracted polio as a kid. So my nieces and nephews just sort of say, oh, uncle, you know, just watch him on the stairs. He's got his walking stick, but it's never about defining that person with a disability. It's just you do stuff, you do it differently, and you might need a hand with some things. So it's really hard to even start to define it then, to break it down on a diagnosis level.
I guess that's a good and a bad thing in a way, because it means that we don't treat people with disabilities any different, which I think is different from mainstream Australia, but it also means that I guess a lot of our mob might fall through the cracks.
That's exactly right. It's that fine line between, you know, not wanting to take away the family's role of how they support members of the family, which is great, but also making sure that people are accessing services and resources that can really help them in that role and they're not slipping through the cracks. And you know, that depends on community. There's some people in some remote areas that hardly ever leave the house because they just can't get out.
I mean, you've mentioned before that you contracted polio when you were a young child. Is this something that's been the reason why you've gotten into this line of work? I mean, how did that affect your life as a young career fella?
So, look, I remember sort of not even being aware that I had a disability as a kid because my family, like I've got five sisters and a brother, and they didn't really treat me any differently, and all my cousins. I still had to muck in like everybody else and do stuff. Although I remember my grandmother spoiled me a bit. I used to get away with a lot of stuff that I didn't get away with.
Good old grandmothers.
Of course. That's what grannies are for.
Exactly, yeah. And so I do remember that as a kid. I think, oh, I don't have to go outside. I can stay inside with Nana. But as a kid, I think I was part of the first trial of taking kids out of special schools. I grew up going to special schools and so forth, which was really weird for me because I'd never been treated any differently. Then put into mainstream schools, and that's when it really hit home. That's when I really noticed I was different and kids could be cruel. Kids picked on me a lot. I used to wear leg irons to get around. I couldn't do a lot of the stuff that was set up in the mainstream school system. It wasn't sort of set up for a kid with a disability. So I think that's where it all started. And I started studying horticulture when I was in my 20s and worked at the Parramatta Girls' Home and Boys' Home, Kambala Towdhury. And I ended up spending more time with the teachers and the kids with disabilities and out in the garden. And I think that's when it all happened. I just thought, oh, I really want to do this. But I think we were exposed to it as well. My mum worked in disabilities. And I often remember Christmas time that we would have kids stay with us that were on peg feeds and tube feeds and young kids with Down syndrome. And so I think that was a bit of a natural progression as well to just, you know, get into the system and start being a bit of a big mouth.
You keep going.
Yeah, just words. So I just started to become a bit of a big mouth and think up my own rights and rights of everybody else. And it was just natural to move into areas like this.
Great. We need people that are prepared to speak out and step up. So it's good that you are able to do that. Polio and First Nations people. What's the rate of polio amongst them? Have you've met other First Nations people that contracted polio as young ones?
Look, no, I haven't. That's the whole thing there. There's not a real great deal of study and prevalence of disabilities. I'm actually one of the youngest people I know to have polio.
How old are you?
I'm 57.
All right.
Mm. Yeah, I caught it I was 18 months old, so like 1960, right. 61. Mm-hmm. And most people are a lot older. And I have come across a couple of people, but it doesn't seem to be huge. And if it is, it's not really, you know, diagnosed as such.
Okay.
So I don't know a real lot, and I'm quite interested to find out how big it is. I have a feeling my gut thing is that polio came around from in Western civilization. It started to come around with the invention of sewerage and all that sort of stuff, and society became a lot cleaner and didn't get that exposure to everyday things that you would normally get exposure to. And apparently that's when it started to come around, because people lost their natural immunity. So my theory is that sometimes in our communities, because we're still doing it tough in some areas, that we still maintained our natural immunities to it. But I grew up in Western Sydney, and as a kid, and so possibly that's why. But look, you know, you don't know. I mean, as I said, I've got five sisters and a brother, and none of them caught it. It was just me.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You mentioned before that you got, when you went into the mainstream schooling system, that's when you started to realise the discrimination and you got bullied. But there's that added discrimination of being Aboriginal as well. Did that affect you being a Koorie fella but also having that disability in a mainstream setting?
Well, I think what it was really weird. I'm a fair-skinned fella. My mum's Irish. And my dad's, big tall black fella, so the afro and everything else. And I think it was weird. I sort of slipped through the cracks a little bit, but my cousins, I would see them copping it a lot and being called names and that as well. But I think back then people were a bit confused. Unless you were, standing on one leg holding a spear with a lap, they didn't associate you with being Aboriginal.
Mm.
My cousins would get it. A couple of my sisters are fairly dark, and they would get called, the horrible names like half caste and boong and all this sort of stuff. But my dad also, when we lived on a settlement out near the banks of the Lanco River. My earliest memory there is a corrugated iron tin shack. We're pretty dirt poor and struggling, but Dad was a hard worker. But whenever the social workers come out to visit, Dad would never be around. He was always a bit scared that if they saw a fair-skinned kid with a disability, that they would take us away. Because, this was before the referendum. This is in the early 60s. So Dad would sort of... We knew who we were and our culture, but we never talked about it out loud for fear of that sort of persecution and that as well. Oh.
That's really scary really sad. I mean, I think it's a common story everywhere. I mean, that statistic you mentioned before, 50% of our mob have a disability or some sort of health condition. When did this sort of advocacy around disability awareness and rights specifically for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people sort of come about? Is it relatively recently?
Look, I reckon it's pretty relatively recently. I mean, I've been working in the industry for 30 years, and it's only been the last few years that we've actually started asking the questions about what's the best way to support our mob with disabilities and how do we do a proper way, like how do we address the cultural significance and needs of people with disabilities. So it's a fairly new conversation. First People with Disability Network Australia is pretty much been leading the way in this. It's the peak body in Australia for issues around Aboriginal people with disabilities, and it's the first organisation, and as far as I know, not only nationally but internationally, that's run for and by Aboriginal people with disabilities.
Because you've got a majority, all the members of your board are all Aboriginal but all have disabilities, don't they?
They're all people with disabilities except for two members of the board who are carers of their children with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
That's very rare. I think even just to have that's an all-Aboriginal board, I think.
Yeah. That's great. Very good. Now, it used to be all the disability issue for First Nations people was under the umbrella of the mainstream organisation for many, many years, wasn't it? And then First Nations people decided it was time to establish our own organisation and take control of our own situation, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. And that's how First People came about. I started from, I think it was a conference up in Darwin called, what was it called? I've gone totally just mentally blank as I went to say it. Telling It Like It Is, I think it was. Mm-hmm. So a paper came out of a conference in Darwin with, it was arranged for people to go away and organise Indigenous disability groups within each state. Mm-hmm. And I think it really only took off in New South Wales. And that was under the guidance of Damien Griffiths, a deadly young fella from down Melbourne way, and that's grown from there. He sort of drove the whole thing with becoming the national peak body of the First Peoples Disability Network Australia. He's actually over in Geneva at the moment. He goes each year and reports to the United Nations around issues around Australia's First People and disabilities.
And
so he's an amazing young man.
Mm.
Yeah, and what are some of the barriers? Because Tiger mentioned before being under the umbrella of mainstream services, I would imagine that a lot of black fellas sort of are on the outskirts of that disability support system. They might not want to access it, or there might not be a language around how they talk about it.
Oh, look, that's so true. I mean, one of the biggest barriers is that first contact point, the whole assessment process of people engaging with a service provider. The whole assessment process, someone going in with a tick and flick board and asking questions just straight away puts people off.
Yeah.
It's even trying to identify, sometimes in services need to identify who the carer is in that as well. And you know what it's like when you go into a family, you could have an elder who's a community elder, just because they've got a disability, suddenly servers will start asking all the questions to their son or daughter and take away that person's authority within that community of who they are.
Yeah.
I can even tell you one story where it falls through the cracks as well, where there was an uncle who was being looked after. He, you know, the community nurse would pop in and see how he was going, and it was a young white girl, and she was very courteous and had a great relationship, and he would chat to her. But, you know, thought everything was okay, just the general health stuff. Then what happened was there was an opportunity where there was a male community nurse that went in to visit him. And then out of that conversation came about that this man had been living with prostate cancer.
Oh, right.
But that was men's business, and he could never talk about that stuff with a young girl. So
yeah.
This man was suffering in silence because he didn't have anyone appropriate to talk about his health issues. And they're just some of the things that people need to take into account is our strong belief in men's and women's business and what you can and can't talk about. And also going into home, you know, being respectful of the family and who's what people's roles are in there as well. So sometimes that straight away puts people offside and it's just too hard and they don't even go in and access the services at all.
Is there a problem in around a stigma or shame? Because I remember I was reading this really good book by a doctor who was working up Galawinku and specifically around crusted scabies, and he was talking about the fact that a lot of mainstream workers come in and they really shame whole communities in the way they treat it. So people want to hide it in a way, and that's just related to scabies and everything like that. But is there that stigma amongst our mob? They might not want to get help?
Oh, look, there's like about 600 language groups in Australia, and that varies as well. In some communities, to have a child with a disability can be because you're married wrong way or something like that. But for the most part, it's sort of just seen as that's how the children are. But services coming in do that sort of stuff with the shame as well. There's a couple of things that I've come across. Like recently when I was in the Northern Territory, we sat down to talk to some elders about what we're up there for and disabilities. And the first thing they said to us, you're not here to take our children away, are you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's still that
that's
fear
so
that
true.
Kids are going to be taken away. And, you know, that's very, very real. I've known nurses. I've sat there once when a nurse was actually doing the dressing on an auntie's foot, and she made this ridiculous comment with, oh, you know, I've lived with near Aboriginal people and they need a lot of practice with their hygiene, don't they? They're not very clean people. And this is coming from a nurse to an auntie. I'm thinking, oh, my God, I can't believe you just said that in front of me.
It really is amazing how they think like this, eh?
Yeah, so this stuff's still out there. So it took a lot, you know, for that auntie to have that service back. In the end, we sort of found another service for her. But they're the sort of things that go on. We had a lady that I know of. She's a fellow Wiradjuri woman that was part of Stolen Generation. She went through hell, part of Stolen Generation. She's actually given evidence at the moment to the Royal Commission in regards to the abuse and that she endured and other people. But she had a support worker once, and she opened up to this person and said that she was part of Stolen Generation. And this support worker made the comment, which wasn't meant with any malice at all, just pure ignorance, but said, oh, at least you had somewhere nice to live and you were looked after and had plenty to eat. And I just see people just aren't aware of you know, people's history and the issues and what Stolen Generation is all about.
No.
So there's many of those sort of things where people need more education in going in to provide services.
You mentioned before fear of having their children taken away. There was a recent study it was last week or the week before about Aboriginal people with disabilities who are actually just coming into contact with the justice system. But one of the statistics was the people they studied, the blackfellas they studied, were 2.6 times more likely to have been in out-of-home care as children. So we don't only have Aboriginal people with disabilities going into the justice system, but they are also being taken away from their families because that's what the statistics say. They're way more likely to be taken away from their families. So it's not an unfounded fear, is it? We've got a lot of Aboriginal kids with disabilities going into foster care.
Oh, very much so. And often kids are removed from their community, not because of poor parenting skills or not being looked after, purely because of the total lack of resources in that community. So the children are then moved into foster care, into major towns. And they may still have contact with their families. But, you know, it's not because of bad parenting or anything like that at all. It's purely because the resources aren't there. So instead of putting in the resources, it's easier just to remove the children and put them into foster care. And unfortunately, quite often too, when children, even with some of the new models of foster care, there's not that commitment that that child will go back to family or back to community. And that's something some organisations are doing it, but I have a lot to do with families at the moment, and their children are in foster care, and they try to have contact and maintain that contact with them, but it's still very hard through the foster system. But I know one young girl has just taken on the kinship carer role for her young niece, who has a disability, which was great, and we all put letters of support in to say what a deadly mum she would be, and it was quite natural as well to be the auntie to take on the role of her mum. We'd love to see more of that. But at the moment, kids with disabilities are often just put into foster care.
That hurts them more, because when we talk about disabilities, we're not just talking about, I guess, physical disabilities, but also mental health and cognitive disimpairment. So that, I would just imagine, being taken away from your family just adds on to that trauma and just adds on to that hurt and furthers that disability, wouldn't it?
Oh, huge, huge. And you're right. Disability isn't all about physical impairment. Mental illness is a huge thing in our community, with depression and, you know, psychosocial disorders. And often people from stolen generation too. We have this thing called intergenerational effects of that, where because of the trauma that they went through being part of stolen generation and the abuse and you know, some people had like good experiences, but that still doesn't compensate for not knowing who your mob is. But some people had really traumatic experiences. And that, if that sort of impacts on their parenting skills, and when they have children, you know, they say that, I don't know how to show affection to my children and that as well. So that causes, you know, these effects for anguish and like mental health disorders in their children. So, but mental health is a huge thing. That healing the spirit is one of the biggest things that we talk about at the moment in regard to disabilities. It's not always about service provision. In some communities, people don't need domestic assistance and personal care. It's not important to them. What they want to do is be able to connect to culture, connect to their community, find their place in the world, and have that sense of belonging. And often that's huge for someone with a mental illness, just to heal the spirit and have that connection and that chance to put back into their community.
When you talk about the services and service provision, is there a big difference between urban, regional and remote service provision for our mob, or is it similar? I guess there'd be different barriers, but how different is it between those sort of three categories for service provision?
Look, there's a lot of same-same, but a huge amount of differences. The big thing in some remote areas is that the services just don't exist in the first place. And some, like some places, for instance, in the Northern Territory and that as well, you're looking at... Utopia, for instance, when it's like 400 kilometres from Alice Springs along dirt road. So to get a service to go out there and provide supports is pretty difficult as well, and even getting that conversation there. And I imagine like going up to areas in Queensland, like Mount Isa. I know in Mount Isa there's some services don't exist in some remote communities, and that's where some children are being put into foster care in Townsville because the services just aren't there. But there's some difference as well. Some of the things that happen in urban areas, you get a lot of people living in more social isolation as well, where they don't know who their mob is, they don't know who's who in the community. And they might have all those services available, but people just don't know how to access them and get to them because there's that lack of communication. And sometimes it's just overwhelming and daunting to even start getting into services. Where in some of the remote areas, you have no services, but often people at least know who they are. People still speak language. That's still that very strong connection to community and to culture. So that often keeps people a lot stronger in regard to that if the services aren't coming in. But it is a big thing with providing appropriate services. A lot of people are jumping on the bandwagon, and unfortunately the only requirements they need for their cultural safety or cultural awareness training could be a one-hour session and a bit of a e-learning.
Oh, God almighty.
Yeah, and then that's about it to be qualified to go out and work with community. I must say, though, on the Sunshine Coast, there's a deadly program up here called Cultural Healing, and I think it's one of the very few Indigenous-specific mental health teams that actually go out and work with community. So those sort of models work really well and engaging with people and connecting with people.
It was in Murujulu a number of years ago, probably only 5, 6, 7, I don't know, and I was out there with work and stuff, but I saw, I think, 3 wheelchairs. Murujulu is the smallest community. 3 wheelchairs, people trying to push through the desert sand.
Oh,
and stuff like this. And it really impacted on me how tough and what challenges these people wake up to each morning. I mean, that's a hell of a thing.
It's huge. Some people get wheelchairs and they can't go beyond their veranda because there's no footpaths or roads.
That's right.
And I can tell you how weird it is too. I mean, I have my walking stick, and when I was up in Alicaran earlier this year, it was so hot. Now, the rubber stopper on the bottom of my stick usually lasts me quite a few months. Within 3 days, it had melted off from the heat, from the red earth. And so just trying to get around like that, I thought, wow, look, and I took a photo of it and showed some friends. I thought the rubber stopper melted off the end of my walking stick. The ground
was so
hot. In a
couple of days,
Wow. So imagine what the impact that has on tyres, all that as well on
chairs
some
stuff.
Of the wheelchairs.
That's right, yeah.
Those things are dumb. I mean, I've seen a lot of those images from Mutijulu in the media about, you know, they're used as this sort of poverty porn, aren't they? Blackfellas in wheelchairs or, you know, used to illustrate stories about petrol sniffing. Those sort of images, they must do a lot of damage to the work you're doing, Paul, do they?
Look, they do. I find them so frustrating because it's like judging a whole community on a few, and everyone has their issues and problems, but what they don't tell the stories about is the incredible strength of the elders in these communities and the young people that are doing the right thing and just really want to make a difference and the keeping culture alive. And, you know, and unfortunately, like, drugs are sneaking in, ICE is starting to have an impact, but that's impacting on a lot of communities that as well. But, you know, for instance, in Alicaran, people talk about, oh, you know, people don't go to work and all this sort of stuff. You know, they need to get rid of the unemployment. It's 250 kilometres to the nearest town, Tennant Creek. Petrol can be over $2 a litre sometimes. So what is the cost of trying to even just drive into town every day to work?
Providing you've got a car and not looking around for a lift in the first place.
And also, providing you're able to work, I guess. If you've got 50% of our mob with disability and health conditions, I mean, that's obviously a problem that isn't talked about in the employment barriers, is it, as well?
Oh, look, there's so many people on Newstart that should be on a disability pension.
Right.
It's just honestly ridiculous. There's people on Newstart who so obviously have a disability, like mental illness. And, you know, I know a story of one young man with an acquired brain injury who can hardly stand up and keep his balance, but they keep putting him on Newstart. And then naturally what happens is he doesn't know how to fill out his forms and everything else, forgets about it, breaches, goes without any income.
Wow.
So it's just ridiculous. And you look at him and say, what is going on here? Why isn't this person on a disability pension?
Is there a problem between sort of trying to decide between a cognitive disability and that mental illness problem? I mean, is that the difference between those two well-defined?
No, it's not. That's going to be a huge issue in regards to the National Disability Insurance Scheme as well, with people accessing it, because at the moment it's designed around people with severe and profound disabilities. And but the thing is, someone in a wheelchair trying to get on a bus, well, someone with a mental illness can just have just as big a barrier with getting on that bus as if they were in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
That whole anxiety with trying to get on there and navigate through society. But the sad thing is that the very sort of episodic nature of people with mental illness means that some days they're travelling okay. And if that's the day the assessor sees them, they're going to be seen as ineligible or they don't need any support, they're fine. And the next day they hit rock bottom and they can't leave the house, they can't do anything. So that's the thing there where it needs to be looked at in regards to the support of people, not only with physical disabilities, but the barriers with people with mental illness and that as well, people with autism. Just trying to function and get out there every day and deal with society is huge. And those things, I think, at the moment are slipping through the cracks. And that's what we're trying to do too, is just make people more aware of that. You know, when people who are living with depression and anxiety and that as well, to talk about not how they're feeling that day, if they're feeling okay, but talk about when they're feeling not proper way, they're feeling really crook. And this is when you need the supports and help, when you can't get out of bed or you can't make a decision to take your medication, or you can't leave the house and there's no one coming in to check on you if you're okay.
Yeah.
So, and look, you know, another horrible fact is a lot of our community's suicide rate with our young people is just horrendous. It's just, it breaks my heart that every time we go out to community, there's another story of a young person who has committed suicide. And yet it's not reported to the attempts as well that happens. So there's a lot we have to look at.
I want to take a break for a song, Paul. When I come back, I want to talk to you about the resources within our own network, our own mob there, to assist and support people with a disability. I want to talk about the resources, the funding, the challenges for you there. Is it sufficient? What are your challenges? But the first question will be not that. It'll be, tell us about the NDIS. We've heard a lot about it for a long time because there was a lot of debate and discussion in Parliament.
Yeah.
I'd like you to explain what is NDIS, please.
Yep.
Tell us about it. So we'll take a break for a song.
Okay.
And come back to you. Our guest today is Paul Calcutt. And
First People's Disability Network and the Murray, local Murray Disability Network up here as well.
Very good. And he's based up at the Gold Coast. We're playing a song. A lot of you mob, I certainly resonate, sort of can relate to this song, Weekend Millionaire, Bill Murray. There's Bill Murray, Weekend Millionaire. Yes, I know a few of them. Our guest today, Paul Calcutt, joining us. And we're talking about disabilities and disability services and First Nations people and our challenges and things. But, Paul, I'd like you to tell us about the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme. What is it? What does it mean?
In a nutshell, it's funded by the government and it's free. And it has huge potential to really do great things for our mob. But it's not going to be the magic bullet to fix everyone with disabilities. And what it is, it's an insurance scheme, and people who are eligible to go into it will receive support for life that helps them with their day-to-day needs. It's under what's called necessary and reasonable for someone to have a good life. And what the process is, that if people are eligible for it, people with severe and profound support needs, they will then be assessed by someone from the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and then they'll have a planner come out and sit down with them and plan different things that they can do that might really improve their life and make things better for them. And then the insurance scheme will cover the cost of providing that support. And then one of the biggest barriers is for our mob is that we want to make sure that they don't slip through the cracks. And
they've got to know about these services and things, because I know people.
Yeah.
That my own grandson, he's 5 years old. He's suffers with dwarfism, but the mother did not know about the disability services, some of the support and assistance she could get. Didn't have a clue about it until 3 months ago, and now she's got the sticker on the car window that allows her to park, and she just a little thing like that parking sticker where you can park with where the wheelchairs are marked, you know, where the disabled parking is.
Yeah.
Little thing like that makes so much difference. It's just unbelievable. It's one little thing. So my point here is getting people to know what their entitlements are or what they can look into, what is available out there. That's a big issue, Paul.
That's huge. And that's one of the main issues for a start, to even get people even to know that these services exist and that they're eligible for it, or if they do know they exist, how do they navigate their way around it and how do they even know what's out there? Mm. And that's a huge thing as well. And that's what we're trying to do at the moment. Our role is to try and slowly get out there and educate our mob on what's out there and helping them have the confidence to go in and ask for it as well. You know, some of the things was recently, which was an example of this sort of stuff too, was recently in the community and started to talk about the NDIS, and I thought they pretty much knew what it was, and they were using an interpreter, and suddenly they sort of stopped and said, oh, what's the NDIS? Wow, they're not even aware of what this is first.
Yeah.
So we talked about that, and then we had a 20-minute conversation trying to define disability and what that was.
Well, I was going to say, how do you define, I mean, the assessment process seems a bit scary to me, because how do you define severe and profound disability as well? I mean, what categories fall into that?
Exactly, and that's how that can vary too, and environmental issues come into that. So, as I said, someone, for instance, who is just in a wheelchair and that in the suburbs can get around, and you know, there's ramps, there's things to be able to access buildings and so forth. It's still severe and profound, but there's the resources in there. Where somebody who's just, for instance, it was just me in a remote community with a walking stick, no footpaths, no roads, proper roads and everything else, that's huge. I've been trying to navigate your way around there. And, you know, with the ends melting off your walking stick and everything else and sinking in the sand. So a lot of environmental stuff goes into it as well. And that's where the assessors come in place, because we need to have people that can sit down and look at the whole big picture for someone to make sure that if they are eligible, they do get into it. They do get into the scheme, and we don't want people that are like gatekeepers.
So we need Aboriginal assessors, really, because when you think about a lot of non-Indigenous, like, they might be great, they might have a good understanding, but there's still that problem. They're very blinkered in their worldview, and it's an unconscious thing. Yep. So we need a lot more Aboriginal assessors in there.
Exactly. Well, they're still, their focus is through a white lens, you know, through white eyes, and that's the biggest problem we have. They're looking through white eyes. Here we are living a black experience, and they never, still the two meet up in a lot of cases. They've got no idea.
That's so true. And that's the thing, too. No matter what the best intentions are, if you sit down and you just don't get it, you're not going to engage with people. You're not going to get the whole story, and you're not going to look at what's really important. And I've heard of people, you know, do assessments and go, the house is too crowded. There's all these people in there. That's not right. And it's like, well, it's all the uncles and aunties and cousins, family, and that's just how it is, you know. Like,
it's exactly what you were saying before about that woman with the hygiene, talking about black fellas don't have any hygiene.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, that might be your standards. You might be really anal with your hygiene. And in my personal opinion, I think that's why we have so many super bugs around, because people are going berserk with disinfecting everything, that we're losing all our natural immunity to stuff, you know? So, but that's a big thing, is just getting people out there. We do need more assessors. We need local area coordinators that are Aboriginal people that have that connection and can be the go-to person as well. And we need to help skill up, the, you know, identify the existing services and people that are already out there doing the work and somehow help them reach whatever qualifications are needed to meet all the standards, but acknowledge what people are already doing and do the work they're doing. And they should be paid. Why can't they become the paid support people to support in our own community?
Why can't it lead to jobs, you know? Yes. Why do we always have to have non-Indigenous people coming in and non-Indigenous services coming in?
Well, I think we need to really seriously look at the qualifications, that this whole focus on a Cert 3 in aged care. Well, you know, that might be okay, but you know, a lot of people don't need that level of support and medication. What they're after is someone that can connect them to culture, someone they can go out in community with. It's like, for instance, you know, you've got a young fella. We have a young man here on the Sunshine Coast, and he has an acquired brain injury through a car accident, and he goes out once a week, but he wants to go out. He goes out with another young Murray fella from up here. So when he's out, it just looks like a couple of mates out. He doesn't want to go out with a 60-year-old woman with a blue rinse or whatever. And you know, he wants to be out so he looks like he's out with a mate. And that's the thing we've got to look at, is the qualifications relevant to what support that person needs at that time.
You're currently, Queensland's rolling it out in only about three communities. One of them is Palm Island, isn't it? It's a very slow sort of NDIS rollout.
It is. It's they're called, I think it's called the sort of early rollout, but it's Palm Island, Townsville, and Charters Towers.
So a lot of blackfellas in those areas.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. And I mean, Palm Island's going to be very interesting too, because I think there's, I could be wrong, I think there's like about 40 language groups in the island. And I think 25, more than 50, almost 50% of the population's under 25. And I don't know what services are out there at the moment, but I'm actually going up, have the huge honour of going up there next Sunday, going to meet the mayor and just talk about what we're there to do, the NDIS, and how would it work in their community. Mm. We don't go in with any idea what it's going to look like. We just say, this is the product. How can we make it work here?
This is what we want it to look like.
Yeah, yeah. So and find out off them what they want to do. Townsville will be the same with some of the outer areas there, and then Charters Towers. But we're also trying to do some stuff out around Mad Isa as well and run some information sessions just to get the conversation started. It's going to be spread rather thin with the resources, but we want to get out there as much as we can and just start people talking about it and saying, you know, you have the right to look at this program and ask, how can it connect me to my culture? How can it connect me to community? How can it keep me strong with my family? How can I help with this relationship? Get people to look at different ways about how can, you know, keep you strong. You know, domestic assistance, personal care, transport, shopping, they're all important. But what else can it do to really help? One community we went to, for instance, their main interest was they had the community centre that needed some repair work, and they wanted that fixed up and the air conditioning fixed, so they had somewhere for the elders and people in wheelchairs to go when it's really hot and just relax and be, you know, do some painting and that sort of stuff. So sometimes what they need is not necessarily a service. its resources for the whole community.
Yeah. Those three communities you've named, Palm Island, Townsville, Mount Isa, have all got First Nations radio stations.
Ah.
So, I don't think Palm Island's working.
That's what I was
going
to say. Palm Island probably isn't in operation, isn't active at the moment, but Townsville and Mount Isa definitely are. So, just letting you know, we have network, a national network of stations, and we need to be linking up with you guys to assist. We have an obligation to try and get this information out to our mob.
So
letting you know, you've got Aboriginal radio stations, Townsville and Mount Isa. It'd be great to try and get an interview, get on air, let them know.
Yeah, just start the conversation up there. You know, I feel also we have a personal, I have a personal responsibility because I know people like Uncle Lester Bustock and people like that back in the 70s who started this whole movement and that and just started. Yeah.
I can tell Tiger knows Uncle Lester. He just started smiling.
There's a lot of funny stories with that bloke and his bloody wooden leg he had. Yeah.
He's on the board for First People.
Is he? Yeah.
Yeah, he's on the board.
Oh, he's got some yarns to tell that bloke.
He's a deadly bloke. I mean, I wanted to sit with him, you know. And that's the thing. And so I think now we've got to pick up the banner and run the baton and run with this and make sure that the work they've done keeps going. And then we've got to, educate the next lot of young people coming through as well to keep going. And we've got to keep that happening.
He's one of our very first people in radio.
Lester Bostock,
one of our very first, you know. He's a pioneer and warrior, for sure.
He's a deadly bloke and love catching up with him down in Sydney. And he sits there, you know, and he doesn't sort of say much, but when he has something to say, he's got that wisdom and that history there.
He does. Amazing
bloke.
He does.
Oh, Paul, the First People's Disabilities Network actually released a 10-point plan for the NDIS rollout down in 2013. Is that being taken on board by governments? It's been nearly 3 years now.
It was accepted by government in its entirety at the time by the Minister Jenny Macklin at the time there, and it is something that's a lot of services do look at it. It's like the guide on how to provide good services, and people that are really keen, or organisations really keen in providing good services and doing stuff proper way, are looking at that. I'm not sure how much it's embraced by the government at the moment. I think they're doing okay. This is the first time that I can recall. In all my years working in disabilities and being a person with a disability, that the government funding bodies and services are finally saying, look, we've got it wrong. How do we do this proper way? How should it look? So to me, I think that's a huge step forward in actually asking for once, you know, how should a good service look? Mm. So I think they're embracing and taking it on board. I would personally still like to see organisations that get any sort of funding to provide services have to demonstrate their cultural safety. And it should be a huge part of the funding agreement to be able to provide culturally safe services to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disabilities. So I'd like to see that go a lot further in regards to, you know, proper way of demonstrating their cultural safety, not just saying, again, that someone did, you know, an hour induction in e-learning in front of a computer or something.
So. Talking about funding, is it federal funding or state funding?
It's a bit of both with that, yeah. So I'm sort of going to be confused on the whole lot. I don't think it's actually Queensland and the Commonwealth have signed off totally yet. It's still sort of being all finalised, but it does come from both.
How secure is it? Is it have you lost money? I mean, how well are you funded? Well, you never ever how well are you funded? That's a stupid question to ask. We're never funded well enough.
No. But I think with the beauty of this one is that there's no actual, individual amounts tied to a person, where normally you would get packages, you've got like $4,000 or $10,000 or something a year to support someone. This is based around their needs. So that's one positive. But I think it's going to be attached to the GST in that as well. So it's supposed to be forever. And I think if they can do this right, it can save a hell of a lot of money in other areas as well. If people are kept strong and kept in their own homes and have a good life, it puts a less of a need on all the health services and that as well. And
what was the fight about? What was the big fight about in Parliament? It was on again, off again, on again, off again, I think, if my memory serves me correctly.
Yeah, look, there was a lot of stuff about it. Mm. Yeah. I'm not savvy on all the political side because it does my head in.
you too.
It's useless, isn't it? When you think of all the vulnerable people out there and they fight over all this political stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My thing is just get it sorted so I can go out and talk to the community and see what it is. I remember a councilman made a comment to me once and he said, He said, the big thing with your mob is your elders is this fighting, this infighting. He said, you need to sort that out. And I go, you know what? And if you want to see a really good example of infighting, tune into Parliament Question Time.
Exactly.
On the
good on you. Yeah. IG, yeah.
But they act like children. That's the difference, politicians.
Oh, yeah. At least our mob, you know, put it out in the open, done and dusted, and that's it.
Yeah.
And get it sorted.
When we talk about funding and services that are already there, I mean, how much impact did something like the Indigenous Advancement Strategy, I know not all health funding obviously went through it, but did that make a big dent in the ability of service providers to deliver for people with disability?
Oh, look, I wouldn't sort of know about that. I wouldn't like to comment in case I got it wrong.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, so what's next for you? I mean, is it just going around to these three communities or you're also involved in the Northern Territory?
Yeah, at the moment I'm doing some work in the Northern Territory in the Barkleyshire where it was rolled out, and that was a huge learning curve for me to go into a remote community and actually see what's working, what's not, and sit down with people and meet some incredible people. And I think that's given me a few skills on how to be respectful and engage with the remote communities here, because as I said to the elders there, if we can get it right here in Barkley, it helps us get it right for my own mob back in Queensland.
Yeah.
So still doing that, and we'll be trying to do some stuff locally as well, just in the Sunshine Coast and Brisbane area, working with my own community there. We run some art groups. We're developing some art groups at the moment around supporting people with disabilities and coming together using art to tell stories and build that resilience and connect the community. We've got an art exhibition on at the State Library at the moment, all by Aboriginal artists with disabilities, and that's called Wallangun, and it means strong heart in Wiradjuri, and that opened on Saturday. So we're trying to, you know, increase the conversation there and get people to even acknowledge that, you know, people with Aboriginal people with disabilities look at it in a very different way, have a very different world view on what keeps us strong and what we need. So and then apart from the Palm Island, Townsville and Charters Towers, as I said, we're going to try and run a few sessions in the Mount Isa area as well, to at least try and get a few yarning circles happening, to at least get the conversation started and get people, you know, to start thinking about it and getting ready for it. And we're doing that sort of through Murray Dam. Now, Murray Dam is the Murray Disability Advisory Network, and I run that in Queensland. And the reason why we call it Murray is because we're a bit tired of everything being called Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander.
Indigenous. Islander, or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Then it got abbreviated to ATSI.
Yes.
And we were just sick of being referred to as ATSIs. And we thought, well, what defines the Queensland mob? So Murray, and we thought, Murray Dan, it's easy, it's catchy to say, ran it by a whole group of Murrays with disabilities and said, does this sound all right to you? Can we work with that? They said, yeah, look, go with it. Great idea.
Good one.
And we hope to even maybe, we thought maybe we might even develop a superhero called Murray Dan eventually or something like that.
Yeah, right. Is there a timeline for a rollout to other communities?
I think it's 2000. I think the whole lot should be around by 2020.
Okay.
2016, we start to, it'll be officially rolled out in the areas we're going to at the moment, but I think 2017 it should be. It's gone all around in other areas now in New South Wales. It's opened up. They've sort of started in the Hunter there, and it's gone into Western Sydney and that as well now, and they're doing that work there. But in Queensland, it's going to be huge. We're going to need a lot of... our big thing is to have local area coordinators, Aboriginal local area coordinators, to get out there and work in communities and start to build it now.
Yeah, because I'm just wondering with mob, it might not be the case for a lot of people with disabilities. They might stay in their communities a lot more. But when you've got a lot of transient blackfellas, I mean, does that affect their ability to access benefits? Or what happens when people move around?
Or go to jail.
Yeah, go to jail.
Or go to jail. I mean, jail must be another story again for our mob inside that have a disability.
That's another issue where, you know, some of the jails have been used as the new mental health institutions.
That's right.
People being held without conviction because of their mental illness or disability. So that's another, that's huge at the moment.
Yeah.
And that's what the beauty of the NDIS, it's supposed to be transportable so people can take it where they go. So if they do move to a different area, they should be able to then take that package and that support plan with them and implement it in another area, providing, you know, those services there in the first place.
You're talking about communities, rolling out to communities, but what about, like, capital cities, Brisbane, big regionals, Rockhampton, Townsville and stuff? Is it happening in Brisbane for Brisbane residents or people with a disability?
Not, Not at the moment. I think what they do is they trial it in, the attitude where, like Brisbane, and they had a lot of services in place, but I mean, you know, as I said, there's still those barriers in the big...
But
I think Townsville, I think what the example there is Townsville's a pretty big regional city, so that's a good example there with the outer fringes of Aboriginal communities. Palm Island is quite a remote, being an island, and then you've got Charters Towers in the rural.
So I think it's a trial type thing, is it?
Yeah, so I think it gives those three examples of how to, you know, iron out the bugs and see what's needed. Yep. And, you know, if we have our way, we'll make sure as many people as we can know about it are eligible for it.
Just before we go, and we only have about 4 minutes, but we're talking to a lady tomorrow about FASD and our mob. In your personal experience, or you're just heading around, you know, talking to different communities, what have you seen around FASD? Is there enough sort of information about it or a way to diagnose it, and does it fit into your work?
FASD, I think it's finally been recognised as a disability, because quite often there was that gap between what was a disorder and a disability, and FASD is having a huge impact on community. And it's an issue that finally, you know, people are starting to talk about that as well, but they've got it so wrong in some respects. I mean, I know one community I was in, there was 150 kids in the school, and I think 45 of them had an official diagnosis of FASD.
Oh, wow.
And so it is a huge issue in community, and there's a lot of education programs at the moment going out around that, trying to educate young people in regards to drinking and that when they're pregnant, and drug and alcohol, drugs taking,
It's been recognised as a disability, so it'll come under NDIS potentially, or?
Yes, we're hoping it will under early intervention with FASD, with kids. So that's what we're hoping to do. And again, it all depends on the assessor going out to assess that to make sure that's recognised and those supports are put in place. So, but it is a huge thing, and it's very much under underestimated at this time, but it's a massive thing. But there's a lot of education stuff going out there, and we're trying to make people aware of it. And the early intervention side of things, with kids with FASD, they get into good structure and routines and that sort of support, will have a huge impact on their later life.
Yeah, and how can people get in contact with you or the First Peoples or the Murray Disability Network?
Murray Dan.
Look, there's two. They can go by the First People Disability website. So just go www.fpdn.org.au, or you can call me. Murray Dan's supported by three organisations: First People Disability Network, Suncare Community Services, Nanjamanji Program on the Sunshine Coast, and Synapse Brain Injury. But if they want to get in touch with me, there's a 1-800 number for Synapse, which you can always get in touch with me, and that's 1-800-673-074.
Excellent. And we'll put it on our Facebook page and website as well, so if any mob out there want to contact the Disability Network, just go to our website as well, or Google First Peoples.
Tell us that number again.
Disability Network.
1-800-673-074.
Right.
And if we can get a group of people together, I'm more than happy to go out and do a bit of a morning tea, take some food out, and sit down, have a yarn with people and answer some questions and just have a bit of a conversation.
We'll bear that in mind if we can organise something, for sure. Listen, thanks for joining us today. It's been a very interesting discussion, and we appreciate the work that you're doing and the fact that you give us your time. Thank you very much for it, and we will talk again.
Great, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
No worries, Paul. Have a great day, man. Bye-bye.
Hey guys, bye.
Very good, Amy.
Yeah, that was really interesting, and we'll keep talking to these mob too. And tomorrow we've got a lady specifically about FASD. We'll be talking about that in more detail tomorrow.
Very good, very good. Make sure you join us tomorrow, Professor or Dr. Professor Jan Hamill. I think Professor Jan Hamill, yeah. Make sure you join us for Let's Talk tomorrow on your local First Nations station.
Evans with a national...